The question is, how in the world does this 3-pound piece of meat in your head produce cognition? How in the world does thinking and language and memory and attention get implemented via this set of neurons in the brain? And it's still a huge mystery, but a fascinating topic to study.
Hello and welcome back to Preoccupied. Today we're going to be talking with Dr. Thad Polk of the University of Michigan. He is a cognitive neuroscience and researcher of the brain and attention.
Dr. Polk's work focuses on the brain, the physical brain, neuroimaging, things like that. And one method of cognitive neuroscience sometimes employs is twin studies. And twin studies, basically, you take identical twins or fraternal twins, but ideally identical. And by comparing them to one another on whatever you're focused on, it can become more clear what factors are inherited from parents and what factors might be more due to the environment.
Yeah, and when we talk about nature versus nurture in psychology, nature is limited exclusively to genetic content, right? So what is the sequence of your DNA? And nothing other than that. So nurture even includes things like environmental influences on the mother while the child is in the womb, that kind of thing.
Right. So everything that isn't pre-coded into your DNA.
Exactly. And that's relevant because we use information from that to calculate percent heritability, which is our estimation of how heavily influenced a trait is by genes.
Right. So Zenon, what would be an example of something that's highly heritable?
Height is a really good example, right up there with IQ and some big five personality traits. And things with low heritability, well, really the lowest heritability characteristic of all is religion, as it turns out.
Oh, that's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Now, I can definitely see some teenage rebellion adding up now.
Yeah, for sure. Or even studies with like children who are separated from their parents and then adopted, right, are more likely to take on the adoptive family's religion than they are their birth parents' religion. Mm. So not very heritable, that kind of thing. Yeah. So when one wants to collect data to determine something as interesting as percent heritability, one has to design a research study using something like a twin study method and then apply to an institutional review board for ethics approval. Maddie, why don't you tell us a bit about that?
Sure thing. So the institutional review board, or the IRB, as it is called in the biz, basically makes sure that all of the subjects that will be involved in this study are having their rights protected and aren't in any considerable danger or vulnerability by participating in your study. Psychology definitely does not have a great track record of that in some of our more well-known studies. Say the Stanford Prison Experiment, some
Milgram.
Yeah. But we're better now.
Because of the IRB.
Because of the IRB, looking out for our awesome participants. Yeah. So, fun fact is Dr. Polk is chair of the behavioral sciences half of the Health Sciences and Behavioral Sciences Institutional Review Board of the University of Michigan.
Indeed he is.
So we're going to get to hear all about his work looking over studies and making sure that the people of the greater Ann Arbor area and all those who decide to participate in serve in the studies that go on here are all in good hands.
Yep. And we're going to get to talk a little bit more about ethics, too, in a couple weeks here, so stay tuned. So once you have your study designed and your IRB has approved, yes, this is an ethical study, now you got to figure out, how am I going to pay for this study? Especially for MRI studies like Dr. Polk conducts.
Yeah, working with technology can get really pricey.
Oh, yeah, because you got to take them to the hospital for these scans, right? And it is a whole procedure. And then you got to pay the participants, too, for the time it takes and, yeah, for all of the lost time. Yeah, seriously.
Things sticking to your head and shit like that.
Mm-hmm. Yep, go lay down in a tube for a few hours while you complete cognitive exercises.
Yeah.
It's a lot, especially when Dr. Polk is working on his dense research, where he is the same participant in the tube for a very, very long time, completing a lot of different exercises, right?
It takes a long time to create a whole map of how somebody's mind gets from one place to another.
Yeah, and as we know, time is money. And that money has to come from somewhere to pay for that time. So that's where we run into the NIH, National Institutes for Health.
Yeah. So the NIH is a government agency that funds research that benefits the public's well-being.
The job of the NIH is to take taxpayer dollars, say, okay, we have billions and billions and billions of taxpayer dollars. Now, who do we give them to do research? And those kinds of applications can be arduous. You have to show that there's theoretical grounding for what you want to study, and also that it aligns with other research that's being done, right?
Right. And also you have to show that what you're doing matters, you know?
Definitely. That there's some potential for meaningful application, right? Yeah. And that's something we talk about a bit with Dr. Polk later. So the last thing we want to talk about is just a little bit about the research behind, as Dr. Polk puts it, graceful aging and being able to age in such a way that you don't become an old coot.
That is the technical term.
What's a better way to put it? You got one? Because I don't.
That's perfect. Dr. Polk suggests four different key components of maintaining your health and quality of life as you get older. The first of these would be exercise, which is horribly obvious, but we all hate to do it.
Yeah, and there's some broad-ranging benefits to exercise, both physiologically and keeping your body running at tip-top shape, and also mentally, in that if you have a scheduled exercise time during which you exercise, even though it's a hard thing, that really builds mental strength and can help combat things like depression and anxiety. And the Department of Health and Human Services suggests that adults exercise 2.5 hours per week at least of like moderate exercise, or if you're into like the intense aerobic exercise, that's 1 hour and 15 minutes a week.
So it's only like 1 hour and 15 minutes to totally improve your golden years.
For the rest of your life, yeah.
That's nothing. Did you know my grandparents, who are 70, mid-70s, bike ride 10 miles a day?
That's crazy. So Maddie, what's another important component of graceful aging?
Well, what's that other thing that people don't like to do that we all know is good for us?
Sleep.
Dieting. Yeah, getting those vitamins, nutrients that you need to keep your bones strong, keep your body strong, and honestly, it helps keep your mind balanced. Like, I feel like the physical part of the brain is not something that we often think about, you know, when we're considering our body's health, but helping make those connections, keep your blood flow pumping. Like, I feel like that's an important thing to consider as well.
Yeah, definitely. Having a well-rounded diet that includes all sorts of foods is really important to make sure you have all the different minerals and vitamins that you need.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure our brains use like an insane amount of the energy that we get
they
from
do,
food
yeah.
anyway. The third component of this is sleep. And the medically recommended amount that we're all familiar with is 7 to 8 hours is average.
Yeah, and there's all sorts of benefits to receiving enough sleep per night. One is that there's some compelling research showing that you don't really form any long-term memories if you're consistently getting less than 6 hours of sleep in a night. So, especially if you're college students like us and you think, oh, it's better to study than it is to sleep. Well, if you study instead of sleeping, you lose all of it because you can no longer form long-term memories, and that's a problem.
So true. And honestly, you will see this. Study, nap, study is a combination I would recommend to anybody.
Yep, and that's great because sleep can help improve your mood, alleviate anything approaching depression, and just generally improve your mental health.
Yeah, reduce your stress, like especially if you're in a place in your life where it's hard to get the amount of sleep time that you need, you probably need a lot more sleep because you're probably really stressed out.
Exactly.
The fourth component that we're going to talk about for aging gracefully is, well, we're going to talk about the MacArthur studies of successful aging. So they took 1,000 well-functioning adults and followed them over a 7.5-year period. And they found that those with consistent and rewarding and numerous social relationships performed better on cognitive tasks.
So, in other words, having repeated positive contact with others can improve your cognitive ability.
Stay in school, kids.
Speaking of talking with cool and awesome people, now let's go to our interview with Dr. Thad Polk.
So we are here with Dr. Thad Polk of the University of Michigan. So hi, Dr. Polk. Thank you so much for being here with us
today.
It's
a pleasure.
So could you briefly describe your background and how you got to where you are today?
Sure. Well, right now I'm a psychology professor at the University of Michigan. It was kind of a long and winding road to get here. I was actually a math major at the University of Virginia back in the 80s. Then I went to graduate school in computer science and thought I wanted to do artificial intelligence at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. But once I started doing artificial intelligence, you can't do that without learning something about human cognition. And the more I learned about the human mind and brain, the more interested I got. And so I ended up doing a joint degree with the psychology department there. That's how I moved more towards cognitive science and cognitive neuroscience, which is what I'm doing now.
Very cool. So how did you get that, how did psychology come into your peripheral from there? You said, okay, thinking about computational modeling and artificial intelligence, how did you go about learning more about intelligence?
Yeah, I guess I was lucky in that I went to a graduate school, Carnegie Mellon, that had pretty close ties between the computer science department and the psychology department. And my PhD advisor, Alan Newell, although he's best known in artificial intelligence as one of the sort of founding fathers of AI, he always was interested in human cognition. And in fact, the project that I worked on in graduate school was trying to develop a computational model of cognition as a whole, so a unified theory of cognition, not just a theory of memory or a theory of attention or a theory of language, but a theory that tried to put the pieces together into a unified computational model.
Yeah, it's looking at that interconnectedness of all these concepts that are just kind of floating in
exactly.
their own departments
yep.
and
yep.
things.
So what questions do cognitive neuroscientists like yourself ask?
Well, I guess at the broadest level, the question is, how in the world does this 3-pound piece of meat in your head produce cognition? How in the world does thinking and language and memory and attention get implemented via this set of neurons in the brain? And it's still a huge mystery, but a fascinating topic to study.
Definitely. So then how do you personally develop research questions in your
work? I think a lot of it is based on what you've done before. So when I was in grad school, I worked on questions that my advisor was interested in, and then slowly moved from that to figure out what my personal interests were. And in particular, even in grad school, I guess I realized that I wanted to get at the sort of primitive components of thought. So the problem, one of the problems with studying human beings is that we're so incredibly flexible and powerful, and we can do almost anything. And so it can be hard to get at mechanisms because we never behave the same way. And that's actually what led me to get interested in the brain and trying to figure out how the underlying neural architecture might work, because that presumably is more fixed and more common across people, even if knowledge and behavior is much more variable. So that's what led me ultimately to start in looking into cognitive neuroscience and trying to ask questions about how the brain might give rise to specific cognitive phenomena.
Right. So the connection of the physical brain with the more elusive mind.
Exactly.
Right. So what research are you most excited about right now?
There are two projects going on in the lab that I'm pretty excited about. One is we call it the Michigan Neural Distinctiveness Project, or the MIND Project for short, where we are trying to examine what changes in the brain as we age, and how might those neural changes explain or underlie some of the behavioral changes that are typically observed with age. So as you probably know, as we get older, many cognitive functions tend to decline. So our memory tends to get a little bit worse, our processing speed gets a little bit slower. And so it'd be nice to know what's changing in the brain that might underlie those changes. And in the MIND Project, we are collecting a big battery of behavioral measures from a bunch of younger people and older people, and we're also scanning their brains, looking at both structure of their brains, function of their brains, and even neurochemistry. And so we'll be in a position where we can actually try to relate some of those neural measures to some of those behavioral measures and maybe gain insight into what are the important neural structures that give rise to behavior. The other project is a project we call the Dense Imaging Project. So I do a lot of neuroimaging research of the brain, where we put people in an MRI scanner and we measure brain activity while they perform cognitive tasks. The way that is typically done is that you recruit a few dozen people and you have them all perform the same task in the scanner, and then you average the results across everybody to try to see what's common. And that's a great approach, but it does have, it does make some assumptions. In particular, it sort of implicitly assumes that everyone's brain is similar. And the truth is, of course, everyone's brain is pretty different. And so I've been concerned that we might be averaging away a lot of the interesting aspects of neural organization. And so in the Dense Imaging Project, we're sort of flipping the approach on its head, and instead of recruiting a bunch of people and scanning them on a small number of tasks, we're recruiting a small number of people and scanning them on a large number of tasks, so that we can really map out an individual subject's brain organization in real detail, in better detail than would be provided by traditional neuroimaging methods.
I have a specific question about, I guess, sort of the nitty-gritty of what it's like to be a researcher. So I've heard some different professors talking who are first getting into learning how to use all this neuroimagery stuff. And I wonder, have you ran into an imaging technology after you completed your education that you weren't familiar with and you had to learn how to use? And if so, how did you sort of learn how to use that in enough detail to be able to use it to research the human mind?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's happened not once, but multiple times, actually. So, like I said, I was trained as a computer scientist. That actually gave me a big advantage because I had computational skills, which you need to analyze imaging data, regardless of what kind of imaging data you collect. But I did not have experience doing neuroimaging from graduate school. So I had to learn how to do that. I learned that sort of via an apprentice model. So I worked with people who did it, and I saw what they did, and I tried to copy them, and I slowly learned to do it myself. But since I started as a faculty member myself, there's still some times when I have to learn some new techniques. And typically, the way I do that is by collaborating with other people who are using it. So one technique that I'm using now in my lab is called transcranial magnetic stimulation. Very cool technique. So basically what you do is you put a magnetic coil up against somebody's skull, and when you run an electric current through it, it will generate a magnetic field that can actually change neural activity underneath the coil. And you could For example, sometimes it's used to temporarily disrupt neural information processing in a specific part of the brain so that you can help figure out what that part of the brain is doing. That's a technique I had never used even after I started as a faculty member. But some of my colleagues here at Michigan, like Mike Vesia and Taraz Lee, do that kind of work. And so by collaborating with them, I was able to get started. And now I have a graduate student that's her main method.
So you mentioned that your skills as a computer scientist have been very useful in your research. What computer languages do you use?
Yeah. So the one I use the most by far is MATLAB. It turns out that neuroimaging research, often you have to deal with images, which you can think of as matrices. And MATLAB is a great programming language for manipulating matrices. And so it's a very useful tool for doing neuroimaging analysis. And many of the analysis packages out there are built in MATLAB, and so using that language is very useful. But the other members of the lab also use Python, and almost everybody uses R, which is the statistical programming language.
So we talked about differences in how people, in their neural imaging, how it looks when they do certain tasks, things mm-hmm. like that. So how does this might be a very broad question, but how does the nature versus nurture conversation, what does that look like within the realm of cognition and neuroscience?
Yeah, well, it's a major theme of research in the field, as you might imagine. And I think sometimes the general public, I think, oversimplifies the nature-nurture debate and sets it up as if it's the answer is either nature or the answer is nurture, when in fact, for virtually any interesting psychological or neuroscientific question, the answer is both, that both genetics and environment play crucial roles in brain organization and cognitive function. In my own work, we've certainly investigated the role of both nature and nurture in brain organization, and we do find quite compelling examples of genetics playing a crucial role in brain organization, but also experience playing a crucial role as well.
Yeah, so that's one of the things we hear a lot about in our classes is things like percent heritability mm-hmm. that people are researching. Is that mm-hmm. something that's sort of in your wheelhouse?
Yeah, absolutely. So I happen to be an identical twin myself,
oh,
actually,
really?
Yes. And we have done a handful, not a lot, but a handful of twin studies from which you can estimate heritability. And yeah, that's, and as you might suspect, it's never very rarely 100% or zero, right? It's yeah. almost always that heritability is, you know, somewhere in the middle, and some traits are more heritable than others.
I'm thinking about ways in which our societal conceptions of aging, you know, we all have, I'm sure, observed, you know, lapses in memory, things like that, and we have this assumption that people as they age become more stuck in their ways, things like that. In what ways has your research at all surprised you or helped you to better understand these conceptions that we have of people as they're aging?
Yeah, yeah. Could I start with a joke to answer that question, actually?
Please.
So these two elderly couples go out to dinner, and the men are talking to each other, and one of them says to the other one, you know, last week I went to this terrific memory seminar, and they taught me all kinds of great strategies and techniques I could use to keep my memory sharp. You should check it out. His friend says, hey, that does sound good. What was the name of the seminar? First guy thinks for a minute. Oh, yeah, what's the name of that red flower with the thorns that smells good? A rose? That's it. Then he turns to his wife. Hey, Rose, what was the name of that memory seminar that I went to last week? And I think that captures a very common view of aging, that it's inevitably associated with substantial cognitive impairments. And the there's a couple of important things to keep in mind when you consider that. First of all, not everything declines with age. So there are many aspects of cognition which are sometimes referred to as crystallized intelligence that often improve with age. So for example, vocabulary tends to get better, world knowledge tends to get better. What many people would call wisdom tends to increase as we get older. And the other important thing to keep in mind is that there are substantial individual differences in how people age. Some people age extremely gracefully and don't show much decline, even in the cognitive functions that on average across people do decline. So, and there are things you can do to help you age more gracefully, like staying physically active and eating a good diet and getting enough sleep and reducing stress and maintaining good social relationships. All of these kinds of factors have been shown to help people age more gracefully. So it's not inevitable that every single person is going to experience declines in all cognitive functions at all.
Yeah. So in what ways has studying all of this and having this information, being an expert on this information, affected your own relationship as you get older to the aging process?
I wish it had affected it more than it has. I mean, it's a case where I sort of, I regularly give talks on aging and provide advice to people on things that they might want to consider doing in order to age a little more gracefully. But the truth is, I don't put them into practice myself. I don't get as much exercise as I could. I don't, eat the best diet in the world all the time. I remember once I was actually preparing a lecture about the benefits of a good diet on aging, and I was writing this lecture while I was sitting in a Tim Hortons stuffing my face with donuts. So, do as I say, not as I do.
Yeah, we find that's pretty common in psychology, is having all the advice and not always following it.
What are some applications of research in cognitive neuroscience and the research that you do aside from what you talked about with graceful aging?
Let's see. I mean, I will say up front that most of my research is pretty basic, so it's more about the scientific study of the neural mechanisms that underlie cognition, and so a lot of it isn't directly applicable, although hopefully by understanding how the brain implements cognition, we will be able to design interventions that help people down the road. That said, I have done a little bit of research on addiction. We did some imaging studies trying to examine what distinguishes smokers who manage to quit from smokers who don't manage to quit. So we did an imaging study where we took a whole bunch of smokers, we scanned their brains while we exposed them to smoking cessation messages that are typically used to try to help people quit smoking, and we looked at their brain activity in response to these messages. Then we followed the people for 6 months as they tried to quit. Some of them managed to, some of them failed to quit, and then we compared the brain activity in the people who did quit versus the people who didn't. And what we found was that the people who quit activated parts of their brain that are associated with processing information about yourself. So when those people saw these messages about smoking, the brain activity looked as if they were relating those messages to themselves. How does this apply to me? Whereas the people who didn't quit did not activate those same self-related processing areas. So how to get people to relate those smoking cessation messages to themselves is another question, but it at least does suggest that that's something we might want to try to do.
So talking about basic research again, what do you feel is compelling about knowledge for the sake of knowledge?
Well, to be perfectly blunt, a lot of it's selfish. Like, I just want to know how it works. I mean, like, to me, it's just, it's crazy that, what our brains can do. And I mean, you know, play the piano or feel pain or, love or altruism or, you know, any of the millions speak a natural language. These are all truly miraculous things that this piece of meat in your head can do. And I just personally and selfishly want to know how it works. So that's a lot of the motivation for me in basic science, is just answering questions that I'm intrinsically curious about.
Yeah, I think that that's plenty of reason to investigate these things.
So in your work here now at U of M, what does a sort of day in the life look like for you?
So academics often divide life up into research, teaching, and service, and definitely my life consists of all three. So a typical day would be to, first of all, I always work in my lab so that I'm there with my graduate students and research assistants and so on, so can interact with them all day. But I typically sit in my lab with my laptop and work on whatever is the most urgent item. So if it's maybe it's some research paper that we're working on that has needs to be revised by a deadline, then maybe I'm sitting there revising a paper about a experiment we did. Or maybe I'm meeting with one of my students about a project that they're working on, and we talk about obstacles that they've hit and ways that we might overcome them. Or maybe I'm preparing to teach, so trying to get a lecture ready to teach the next class, or responding to one of 100 different student emails that I've gotten about the class, or doing something related to service. So right now I'm serving as the associate chair for the department, which has a bunch of meetings. So basically I have to, you know, attend a number of meetings about running the department on any given day. So I could be doing, typically a day would involve all of those things, something related to research, teaching, and service.
Okay. And then sort of a follow-up on that with the service, what does your involvement with the IRB look like?
Yeah, so I chair the so-called HSBS side of the IRB. There are two branches. There's the IRB Med that deals mainly with medical research, and then there's HSBS, which mainly deals with behavioral research that isn't medical in nature. And I serve as the faculty chair for the behavioral science side of the IRB. So for that, we need to review basically every project at the University of Michigan that involves behavioral research with human beings, to make sure that the participants in the studies are being treated with respect, and that all of the procedures that are being used are safe, and that the participants know what's going to happen to them and provide completely informed consent. And so for that duty, I have to review proposals that for research that's going to involve human subjects. I have to attend meetings where we make decisions about whether to approve different projects. So yeah, there's a number of different parts to that job.
Okay, so then you review the proposal individually, and then everyone comes together at the meeting to make a decision?
Yes, there are many, many reviewers. So typically, any individual proposal would be reviewed by at least one person. And in the case of more complicated studies that might have to go to the so-called full board for review. They would typically be reviewed by at least two people. Those people would then present the research to the full board, the IRB board, for discussion, and we would talk about it and then decide whether to approve it or what contingencies might apply that have to be changed before the research could be approved.
Okay, so for one of those more complicated projects, say with two reviewers and then presenting before the board, how many man hours is that of reviewing?
Well, I'd say each reviewer probably spends 3 or 4 hours reviewing the project, and then the meeting itself is usually about 3 hours long. So not for one project, we'd review your 6 or 7 projects during a given meeting. So, but a given project, and then if you throw in the staff hours who've looked at it before it even got to a reviewer and have done a full staff review, it's probably on the order of 20 man hours per project that goes to the full board, something like that. Wow. Yeah.
So it's quite an ordeal then to get something through from proposal to being able to work on it then.
For complicated projects, it can be. Okay. We do actually pride ourselves at the IRB, the behavioral science side, of really streamlining the process. I think the University of Michigan is sort of at the forefront of efforts to reduce burden on investigators. And so we took our timeline for review for most projects is on the order of a week. We a lot of projects don't have to go to the full board. In fact, it's something like, you know, less than 5% actually end up getting to the full board. Most can be handled by the staff via so-called exempt or expedited reviews.
So you're not just a researcher or a service member, as you described, but you're also an award-winning professor. I feel like I'd love to talk about that a little bit. So how do you capture a group of 300 19-year-olds with their laptops out?
Yeah. Well, I don't always succeed, that's for sure. And I don't know, just by way of background, I'll mention that it is definitely an acquired skill, which I didn't always have. So one of the weird things about academia is that in grad school, you're taught mainly to do research. You're not really taught to teach. You may have some experience serving as a teaching assistant, but it's pretty rare for a graduate student to, you know, design their own course and teach it themselves. And so I remember when I first came to Michigan, especially after coming out of computer science in grad school, and I got here and I was, you know, expected to teach this 300 student Introduction to Cognitive Psychology course. And at the time, I felt I was closer in age to the students I was teaching than to my faculty colleagues, actually. And I wanted to be cool. I wanted to be accepted. I wanted to be, you know, popular and so on. So I remember walking into my very first lecture, and I wore jeans and a T-shirt to try to keep it casual. And I looked much younger than I look now. And I walked up to the podium, and some student in the back thought I was a student who was fooling around, and he yelled out, "Sit down!" I said, "I'm actually the instructor for the course." And so, yeah, now to this day, I wear a tie every time I lecture. But yeah, I think, you know, it takes practice, and public speaking can be terrifying. So it just takes a while of teaching the same material and finding out what works and what doesn't. And I guess the bottom line is trying to be on the student's side. So in my experience, classes can go sort of one of two ways. They can become adversarial, where this students view the instructor as an adversary who's out to get them. Mm-hmm. Or you can become an ally, where the students are trying to learn and you're trying to help them learn and you want them to do well on the exams and you're doing everything you can to help them. And I think one thing I've definitely learned is the more you can side with them and be an ally for them and help them with and encourage them and so on, then they'll forgive a multitude of sins. So you don't have to be perfect as long as they realize that you're on their side and you're trying to help them.
That's a very good rule of thumb. It's an excellent perspective to have for it, because you can definitely tell the difference.
How do you anticipate the field of cognitive neuroscience might develop in the next few decades?
That's a good question. Let's see. I guess three things pop to mind. First is methods. Methods are always developing. I can remember, when I was in grad school, neuroimaging was really just starting. It was just in its infancy, and I could never have anticipated how the field would have changed. But it's kind of like all of a sudden neuroscientists now have a microscope that they never had before. Right now we can actually watch the human brain in action while people perform cognitive tasks. So that dramatically changed the field. And I'd be very surprised if similar methodological developments don't change the field in dramatic ways in the coming decades. Number two is, and this is a personal hunch, but I mentioned earlier my interest in sort of dense person-specific studies, and it's not the standard in the field, but I wouldn't be a bit surprised if it became much more common to study individual people in much more depth as opposed to studying a lot of people at a sort of shallow depth, so that we can really begin to dive into how your brain works and how it is organized and get a really accurate picture of that. And the third thing is applications. So I think a lot of times science is driven by how, the problems that people are facing and how we might solve them. So in the case of neuroscience, certainly there's plenty of health problems associated with the brain. And a lot of our funding comes from the National Institutes of Health, for example, and typically that funding needs to make some connection with disease. And so I think those practical clinical applications of neuroscience are, if anything, going to become even more important and stronger in the future.
How has studying psychology influenced how you view other people in the world?
Well, I guess one thing, studying the human brain in particular, I think has made me appreciate human beings maybe more than I did before I studied the human brain. Just the incredible complexity and intricacy of the human brain is astonishing to me, and we all have one. And I guess it gives me an appreciation that everybody has this deep inner world that nobody else knows about, and the inner workings of their mind. How does it? What are they thinking? How are they feeling right now? It maybe has given me a renewed appreciation for what the inner life of other people might be like.
Very poetic for a more computational person. What's one piece of advice you would give to an undergraduate who wants to do what you do?
A couple things come to mind. One is follow your passion. So like many careers, a career in scientific research, especially in the academy, has challenges. And one sort of brutal fact of life in my field is that we produce more PhDs than there are faculty positions. And so you know, just do the math, that it's going to be very competitive to get a faculty job. So you got to really want to do it. You can't just be a sort of side thing. Well, maybe I'll, you know, become a faculty member. No, if that's what you want, then, you know, you got to be very passionate about it. Let's see. I guess the other thing is to get involved in research. If you know you do want to pursue a career as a faculty member doing scientific research, then there's no better way to get started than to begin doing it. So find out about the research that your professors are doing and figure out. Maybe even, you know, look up some of their papers. This is all in the library. You can find the papers that your professors are writing, and look at their websites and so on, and find the people who are doing work that really lights your fire, that you're really excited about, and then contact them and express your passion for what they're doing and your knowledge of what they're doing, and ask for opportunities to maybe volunteer to work with them. I've had the pleasure of working with well over 100 Michigan undergraduates now over the course of my career, and it's one of the highlights of my job, actually. These students are just brilliant and really interested in a variety of different topics, and I love working with them. So I think some students are sort of reluctant to reach out to faculty members, and it's certainly true that, you know, faculty members don't always have openings. I certainly don't always have openings, but there's no harm in, you know, doing your homework, finding out what people are doing, and then asking if you could be involved.
So this is a question we're just starting to ask, kind of curious what books that you might recommend, maybe one that's relevant to the work you do and one that isn't.
You know, for this audience, there are a number of books on how to be a successful student that I would recommend. So as a cognitive psychologist, I can tell you there's a whole bunch of research on how to study effectively, and most students don't do it. Yeah. So, for example, most students study by rereading their textbook or by highlighting and then looking at what they highlighted. It turns out those methods are among the least effective study strategies, and much more effective approaches are things like testing yourself repeatedly and spacing out your study, so studying a little bit at a time over an extended period of time. And there are now books on the effectiveness, you know, what methods are most effective. I'm blanking on titles at the moment, but How to Be an All-Star Student, I want to say, might be one of them. Or and there's a guy named John Dunlosky who does a lot of this research, who I think has recently written a book, as well as Roger Roediger, whose titles I can't think of.
Okay, no, we'll look into it.
Okay, and then let's see, Well, one book that had a big impact on me was a book by M. Scott Peck called The Road Less Traveled, which is actually kind of a psychology book. He's a psychologist, but basically, it starts with the premise that life is hard, and I think many people don't always appreciate that life can be hard. But just recognizing that you will face obstacles. Everybody faces obstacles. You're not alone when you face obstacles, and it's normal to, you know, have struggles and to feel doubt and anxiety and so on. You're not alone when you feel those things, and you know, it offers some hope in how best to deal with those kinds of problems.
Very cool. Thank you so much. That is all the questions that we have for you, but we really enjoyed talking to you. Yeah. So thank you so much for doing this.
It was my pleasure. Thank you. Enjoyed it.
A huge thank you to Dr. Polk for all of your insight and sharing your experiences in the field with us. Also, a huge thank you to Dr. Weissman for the referral. Please make sure to share our podcast with people you think would like it and to like us on Facebook, Twitter.
Follow us on your favorite podcast platform.
Yeah, that's right. Hit that subscribe button.
Yep. Send us an email to hosts@pre-occupied.com. All these links and such are in the show notes.
And if you feel so compelled, please leave a super nice review for us.
Yeah. And we will see you next time on Pre-Occupied.
Holy shit. Okay, one more time. I need this to not be in the episode. Okay.
It's going to be the end part, don't worry.